You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
All right, everyone. Welcome. My name is Will McCants. I direct the project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world here at Brookings. Today, we are here to talk about countering violent extremism through early interventions program. And Brookings is doing this in partnership with the program on extremism at George Washington University and the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. Joining us today is Lorenzo Vedino, to my right, who directs the program on extremism at George Washington University. To his right is Rashad Ali, who's a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. To my left is Angela King, who is deputy director of Life After Hate. And to her left is Daniel Kohler, who's a fellow at the program on extremism at GW and founder and director of the German Institute on Radicalization and De-Radicalization Studies in Berlin. Okay, so the countering violent extremism discussion has been going along for several years now. If the phrase sounds vague to you, it's also very vague inside the U.S. government and foreign governments. No one is quite sure what this thing means. I remember when I was working at the State Department, I asked another agency to give me a list of everything that had been justified to the Congress as countering violent extremism across all agencies of the U.S. government. Pretty amazing. Everything from building forward operating bases in Afghanistan to English language programs for young mothers. Essentially, it became a way for the government to protect their budgets and their programs. In an effort to become much more focused, we are here today to talk about one slice of this that's often neglected, but I think honestly is the most valuable the effort to stop or counter recruitment for terrorist organizations, and that is early interventions. And so I wanted to begin our program today by asking Daniel Kohler to tell us what early interventions programs are, how they differ from other programs, say de-radicalization for foreign fighters and what have you, and then we'll get to a more wide-ranging discussion. Daniel?
Thank you for the introduction. Thanks for the invitation. Really excited to be here. Early intervention as part of countering violent extremism is really kind of an interesting term. Usually when we look at Western European countries or other states in their counterterrorism policies, we see that there are three types of tools they usually use. The first one is prevention. So usually anything that is related to education, civil society, anything that tries to prevent people from ending up in radical milieus and groups can be seen as a tool. The second level is repression, containing an actual existing radical threat. This is law enforcement, anything that is related to courts, group bannings, house searching, sting operations. And then we see the third level, which is called intervention in most Western European countries. So early intervention would mean that we actually have someone who is in the process, in the early process of a violent, potentially violent radicalization process, but has some connection to it. It has some connection to radical group, some connection to radical ideology, is on a path that is considered dangerous. So it is part of those tools where de-radicalization programs, family counseling programs, counter-narrative programs, projects are part of. Early intervention programs or tools usually focus on the social affective environment of those persons who are about to become a violent radical. So we know from terrorism studies, from criminology, that there is a phenomenon called leakage, that many persons leak some kind of information, some kind of sign, directly or indirectly, to their friends, their families, their colleagues, their employers, anyone around them. And these persons are usually the first one to notice a change, to notice a potential threat, a danger. And in most cases, these so-called gatekeepers, associate gatekeepers, do not reach out to the authorities, do not reach out to the police or anyone else because they feel a strong sense of loyalty obligation to their friends and family members. They fear what might happen to them. They fear that maybe they are making matters worse. Maybe they are the ones responsible for their son and daughter being put into jail for 20 years. So we need to figure out a way to give these families, friends, these associate gatekeepers, a tool, a neutral third-party mentor they can address, they can turn to for assessment, for advice, for counseling, but also as some form of intermediary between authorities, between social services, health services, to give them an understanding, an assessment of why this is happening in their family or in their environment. And these early intervention tools are really those who focus on friends, family, colleagues, to give them a tool as early as possible to reach out and ask for help. Later tools would be die-hard or hardcore de-radicalization programs for returning foreign fighters or those in prison who already are in prison inmates. So these programs are much more specialized and focused on the individual level. And early intervention tools, for me, are more the effective meso-social tools. And there are many out there, family counseling or specialized trainings for teachers, for police officers, for community leaders.
So, Daniel, to my mind, these kind of programs make a lot of sense because it's a small population that you're working with. They have already demonstrated they are interested in radical ideas, but generally they have not committed any violent crimes yet. So you're working very, very close to the problem, and the game is to try and make sure that these folks don't go over the line and commit a criminal act, particularly a violent criminal act. But Lorenzo, these programs have been, they haven't caught on in many places, particularly here in the United States. When we talk about countering violent extremism, you know, it runs the gamut, as I said, but this is not really part of it. Working in this space is usually, from my experience, often left to law enforcement. People that are already entertaining radical ideas are thought to be a security risk and better to let law enforcement handle it than have these early interventions. Give us the scene from Europe. How does that compare with the United States?
It's very different. And first of all, let me open by thanking you for hosting us here. It's very good that we have this conversation in a way that we partner together on this, and we try to mainstream some of the debate that comes from Europe and the experience that comes to Europe. That's why we decided to bring people from the European experience, because that's, in some European countries we've seen 10, 15 years of this kind of intervention. Indeed, the term CV, as you said, it's a very amorphous term. Everybody makes whatever they want out of it. And a lot of the attention in the U.S. has been focused on sort of the large target, the counter-messaging, the counter-narratives, the engagement of communities, which is also extremely important. And the Europeans have done that kind of work, also the pro-integration work with the never-ending dilemma on whether lack of integration is linked to radicalization. But this kind of very large, to some degree, even social engineering programs that the Europeans have spent a lot of resources on are very difficult to assess. It's very difficult to prove essentially the negative, that what you are doing stops people from radicalizing. And I think what we have seen over the last few years is that the Europeans have focused more on the one-on-one intervention for some of the reasons that Daniel was also mentioning. In the U.S., as you correctly pointed out, that has not been the case. We've seen a lot of counter-messaging, whether it's more on the foreign part of it, so the State Department, which you know full well, or on the engagement with communities, which is basically what CVE has been on the domestic front here.
But Lorenzo, can you explain for the audience what we mean by engagement with communities, what that ends up looking like?
Yeah, this is what basically DHS and a variety of the NCTC, the FBI itself have been doing for a long time, which is building trust-based dialogues and relationship with communities. I mean, we have to specify, because you're absolutely right, we have to specify that basically this is probably one of the points of contention, and one of the most debated points is that CV is, I would say, unfortunately limited for the most part to the Muslim community. It's limited to targeting what was traditionally known as Al-Qaeda-inspired radicalization. Today, I guess, would be ISIS-inspired radicalization. And, of course, there's a never-ending debate as to whether it is correct and whether it should be actually focusing also on other forms of extremism. And I think most people would agree that it should be, nonetheless, 99% of the resources are devoted just to the religiously inspired form of extremism. I think in the U.S. we're limited basically to we have been limited mostly to engagement. We're starting to see signs that the idea of working on these one-on-one interventions, the FBI uses the term off-ramps, the idea of doing these very tailored interventions, which if successful, are quite cost-effective also. And it's much easier to prove the effectiveness, so not very easy, but easier than some of the larger programs. They can be very effective. And the European experience tells us that. So we have very different models, and I think that's what Prashad and Daniel will talk about largely, depending on what the degree of the involvement of governments and a variety of other factors. In the U.S., we're starting now to talk about utilizing these tools. I think traditionally we have seen a law enforcement-based approach, the traditional use of sound, but very harsh, law enforcement techniques. The FBI is basically in charge of investigation. So if the European approach, and I'm simplifying things a bit, is on individuals who are clearly radicalized but operating in a pre-criminal space, the European approach is to try to push, to pull back people into a pre-radicalization stage. The FBI approach has been, in some cases, of course, to try to push the individual to have this kind of sting operations, have the radicalization process go further in a control setting with the FBI controlling everything, and eventually arrest the individual. So two different philosophies, and I think there's a variety of factors that contribute to that. But there's a growing realization in the States that that kind of tactic cannot be used all the time. It's very effective, particularly from a prosecution point of view, a very high success rate in courts, but it cannot always be used. We're seeing more and more cases of minors with radicalized. They're attracted to ISIS ideology, and it's difficult to use for a variety of legal and ethical reasons to use sting operations when it comes to minors. The numbers are also very high. We hear from the FBI a couple of weeks ago talked about 900 investigations open nationwide on individuals linked to Syria and mostly to ISIS. That's a very big number, unprecedented from the past, and it's difficult to tackle all these cases with the traditional law enforcement tools. And I think that's something that the Department of Justice fully understands and is trying to explore some alternative tools. Just to give you an idea, just this morning we had meetings with the Department of Justice with a particular working group that is trying to find alternatives to prosecutions, because we understand that we cannot arrest our way out of this problem. So the idea is, and that's why I think the two of us, and of course Shane has been instrumental in this, had decided that it was useful to, that it was useful to sort of introduce some of the tactics that are used in Europe in order to advance the debate in the U.S. Obviously, not all the tactics that have been used in Europe can be used, can be transported and adopted here in the U.S., but there are a lot of ideas that with the proper caveats, with the proper adjustments, could be used here.
Daniel, I want to come back to you just to get a sense of what's going on in Europe, because I know in terms of early intervention programs, it's uneven across the continent. Some countries embracing this, some not. Which country would you hold up as the exemplar in putting together early intervention programs, and why?
That's impossible to answer, because most Western European countries have their own philosophies regarding CVE, regarding de-radicalization. You can have a country like Germany, for example, where they have almost 20 years of experience and practical work against the far right, the extreme right, neo-Nazi groups, and they have, at least the last count was that they have 12 to 15 specialized de-radicalization programs in the area of far right extremism. They all have very different approaches. You can have a country like Denmark, where they have a very state-focused, centered, police-run, centralized de-radicalization program, where everything runs through the police, the Aarhus, the famous Aarhus program. You can have countries like Sweden, where they have one or two strong NGOs doing that kind of work in cooperation with the government. You can have countries like the UK, where they have a strong civil society component, or France, again, in turn, intelligence-led, intelligence
control. So it depends a lot on the political culture.
Absolutely. It depends on the question whether or not ideology should be part of the program. Mm-hmm. Do they talk about dismantling radical ideology at all? Mm-hmm. It's not that popular in Denmark, not that popular in the UK, very strong in Germany, for example. I would say that de-radicalization or intervention programs can be ranked or classified according to three criteria. First is the role of the ideology. Technically spoken, do we have a disengagement program without ideology, just a physical role change, getting someone out to do or to stop committing criminal acts, versus de-radicalization, really trying to get a dismantling of radical ideology, changing the worldview, political or religious worldviews. Second criterion is it state or non-state? Is it run and organized by a government body like police, social services, anything like that? Or is it non-governmental based? And thirdly, is it active or passive? Is it actively reaching out to the target group in prison, or is it just knocking on the doors? Germany, some programs do that. They have a list where the neo-Nazis live. They just go there, knock the door, and ask if they want to leave the movement. Or are there passive programs? Are they waiting to be contacted by those who want to get out and want to reach for help? So in Europe, over Europe, we have seen a very, wide and broad array of different programs and constellations. I would argue the most promising aspect are public-private partnerships, because usually there are aspects that are being done more effectively by government bodies and on the other way around, more effectively done by civil society organizations. So we have seen several attempts in Germany, in Sweden, or in the UK, where a government body started a core, like a hotline or any kind of core program, incorporating civil society organizations that do the long-term counseling in a specified framework, like ideology is part of the program or not, how long should it take, anything like that. So I would say Germany and Denmark are definitely on the forefront of that.
Okay, thank you very much. Angela, I want to try and give people a sense of how one of these programs really works in practice. And you work at an institution that focuses on far-right extremism. So I'd like for you to just talk about how an early intervention works with somebody who hasn't yet broken the law. But I also wonder if you could say a few thoughts about the role of ideology, not necessarily in terms of inspiring someone to do it, but when you're doing these kind of interventions, do you really need to deal with the ideology, or do you focus on other things first?
Well, it's been a little slow going. We don't have as developed programs as Europe right now. But with what we've done, we're out there doing interventions, doing counter-messaging, doing CBE, and for us personally, we have not found that it's successful to immediately go in and aggressively attack the ideology. What we do is share very real, raw human experience and connect on a different level. I think it's important to mention that we really have to be aware of what propels people into these movements. What's broken? You know, what is the underlying issue that made them feel they were missing out on something, that they needed to belong, you know? And that could be trauma. It could be abuse. It could be, you know, a variety of factors that that really push people into it. So when we go in and we, you know, talk to an individual, we have an understanding of what drove them there. That kind of gives us the foundation and the base that we work from. We draw on our own experience. Life After Hate was founded and is completely run by former violent far-right extremists. So instead of judging the individual, instead of attacking the ideology head-on, we ask them personal questions. You know, what has affected them in their lives? What is important to them? What are they interested in? What are their goals? And from there, we fall back on our own personal experience and share that in a way to show them that they are not alone, that they're not the only ones, that it is absolutely possible to disengage, to de-radicalize. But at that point, they're not concerned with being de-radicalized necessarily. And the referrals that we get come from a variety of places, whether it's a parent who's worried about a child that may be getting involved, some government referrals, human rights, and then we have people who contact us on their own and say, listen, I am thinking about getting involved in this. I have a certain belief about a certain thing, or I had this experience that's really pushing me in this direction, and but I don't know. I'm not sure. Can you talk to me about why I shouldn't, or, you know, what are the consequences, or, you know, things like that. So it's been in that way that we've been able to go out and start having successful interventions. And these are literally some of them people who, by their own account, are on the verge of committing acts of violence who then are prevented from doing so.
Are you doing any of these interventions purely online, or is there always a real-world component?
Both. There have been cases where we have traveled in and done face-to-face, sit-down interventions. We get contacted a lot via social media, by our websites, and we definitely don't have the funds to travel the country, you know, to do a personal face-to-face every time. But part of what we offer is one-on-one mentoring, whether it's phone calls, text messages, social media, and we, you know, get these individuals involved. For instance, we have a private group that consists of almost 30 former violent far-right extremists. And these individuals, some of them have been disengaged and de-radicalized for decades. Some of them have just now come out, literally within days or weeks or months. And we are using that network as a means of support, as a means of talking through issues, some of those issues that propelled them in the first place. And it provides kind of the support that Daniel talked about, you know, whether it's a family or, you know, a community, that kind of support that is not there to say you're horrible because you believe these things. It's let me share my experience and how I got beyond that and finding that common ground.
Have you ever encountered anyone who was radicalized purely by what they had read? They're normal in every way, high functioning, but just consumed a lot of hate literature, or is there always something else underlying it?
Every case is different. Some of the information that we're finding now is that not every person suffered trauma or abuse or has mental health issues or anything like that. Some people came from perfectly stable, loving homes and for some reason felt a need to belong in that way. And it's different. You know, some individuals, a small percentage, were actually raised in an extremist environment that were taught violence. You know, there are individuals who were raised in a prejudice household or, you know, they were taught racism literally as children. Some will grow up and rebel against that, and others will grow up looking for a place and say, this is it. This is what I already know. You know, this is what I was taught. And there are individuals who will have maybe one experience that from that point on, pun intended, it literally colors their view of the world from that point on. And then there are some who will just read, you know, history or, you know, maybe think something's happened unfairly in history or, you know, one group is being represented more than another. So it's, we can't classify it all across the board. It really literally is case by case.
Thank you. So, Rashad, I want you to help give us the UK perspective on this, but I also want you to talk about the role of ideology. Again, because I think for many people, when you're thinking about early interventions, the first thing that would come to mind is you need to take on immediately the ideas political radicals would espouse. Have you found that to be the case in your experience when we're talking about Islamist radicals? Or is it like Angela says, that you're going to come at it obliquely by looking at some of the more deeper personality issues or societal issues that have drawn this, pushed this person into this viewpoint?
Yeah, I'll probably start with the latter question, actually. And I think in our experiences, what you have is, I look at four broad trends just to make it easy, although, as you mentioned, all the individual pathways are very different. There are those that have a political perspective, they have a political lens, they buy into a narrative, and they look at the world as very, you know, similar to kind of what was old school left Marxist narrative. You have the evil capitalist West, which is hegemonically dominating the world, and at its forefront is America and its allies, which is suppressing the natural, you know, the natural aspirations of most people in the world. And in this instance, the conflict used to be communism and the West, and now it's Islam. And they buy this type of political narrative, and they look at everything in the world through that. So they look at Israel, Palestine, through that ideological lens, or political lens, if you like. They look at any conflict, whether it's the Iraq war, is it a war against Iraq because of various different economic, socio-political reasons, maybe. But actually, it's a manifestation of another attempt of America to dominate over the Middle East and suppress the rise of Islam. So all of everything is viewed through that lens. Then you get others who actually, they are not politicized as such, but they've had various different grievances, personal and socio-political grievances, in the sense that actually they may have had questions which they faced in their life which related to their identity. They may be questioning their sense of belonging to wider society. They may have had grievances related to racism or personal experiences of disenfranchisement, and therefore the narrative appeals to them because of those things. They're approaching it because actually they already feel they need something else. You then have others who have neither necessarily had a specific problematic set of grievances or a embracing a political ideology, but are very much embrace a form of religion which automatically separates them from everybody else. So therefore, they are separated from other Muslims who they see as not being true Muslims or not Muslim enough. They are analogous, I guess, to what you may have experienced as puritanical. And they have, from there, a religious inspiration for their political worldview. So the way they then look at the world is nothing is really truly representing the pure Islam that should be enforced over society. That actually the pure Islam that comes from a very direct engagement with scripture tells them exactly what is right, what is wrong, what should be enforced over society as law, and therefore they have this very theological political ideology. And then you have, I guess, the other trend of people that do actually just suffer various different ailments. They all suffer various different mental health issues. And therefore, those things have pushed them towards embracing a black and white perspective, and therefore, Islamist ideology is appealing in that context. And obviously, I've described them as four general trends, but actually most people will be a mix of those things. And therefore, when tackling or engaging with an individual, you need to be able to ascertain what are the push-pull factors. Is it someone who has embraced theology, which is telling them that this is, you know, this is what the meaning of Islam is. It is a political ideology which is aimed at ruling the world. That when they're reading scripture, I don't know if you have a Quran belt in the US, but they're reading scripture. And I thought that was quite a good analogy. But if you're reading scripture in that way, and it should be enforced, and the government's role is to enforce that particular interpretation of scripture, and there's only one view, it's very totalitarian, then actually, I guess the only way you can engage with that person is to break down the methodology and the way they're approaching scripture. On the other hand, if someone has a particular worldview that is very, very narrow, then the only thing you can do is make them realize the complexities in the way that the world is made up. And this actually works in the UK in politics as well, I guess. If you've ever been to Kosovo or Bosnia, then you meet little young Tony Blairs and little young Bill Clintons. Because actually, they were then loved figures who went in and were saviors towards the people in Kosovo and Bosnia. That isn't the case in the UK. Tony Blair is not the most popular politician in the UK. But at the end of the day, once they start to see there's a complexity to their worldview, then you can start to have more complexity and nuance in the way you understand people, society, and religion as well. And then you will have other people who actually they do need their grievances addressed. They do need their needs met. And I guess that was the UK approach is multidisciplinary, is a multi-pronged approach. So the formal kind of counterterrorism measures, we have the contest policy in the UK, which is the broad counterterrorism measure, which has the what they call the four Ps. Protect, you know, so as an example, there are now boulders outside the US Embassy in London to stop cars driving into them. There's practical measures that are done in that respect. There's prepare, which is when those cars do crash into those boulders, how do we respond? And the other two areas of counterterrorism strategy are pursue, which is investigations, intelligence gathering, finding plots, disrupting them, arresting people, and prosecuting them. And prevent. And prevent, then, is this area of what we've spoken about now, the individual kind of engaging with people who are either vulnerable towards radicalization or have become radicalized. And therefore, that works in the prison space, in the probation space, and also primarily in the pre-criminal space, which is people that have been referred, whether it's by police, the public in general, or as an example in the cases that we have, you know, as an example in the UK, whether it's from mosques and communities, they've said, we've had one young individual that's come into the mosque, he's started practicing Islam, he wants to know how he can fight jihad in Syria. We don't really know how to deal with this. They will contact the authorities and say, how do we deal with this? The authorities will then send someone who is appropriate to engage with that individual to make an analysis, a diagnosis, and then put a plan in together.
But there's been some criticism of the program as well, right?
Huge.
Why?
Huge. So I think this is, and I think it's very important to look at, because actually I think there are some very good questions, ethical questions that we need to ask. So the first is, in what we're talking about, the language is pre-criminal. We're talking about engaging with somebody before they've gone on to commit a violent act. And so there are natural concerns about how do we determine that, what type of referral process, how do we know this is the case, and is it just not led by pseudoscience, etc., which is a reasonable kind of concern to have. The second, I guess, is the broader moral question that actually when engaging in de-radicalization, especially with someone who has a theological foundation, actually what you're going to do, and there are a number of different approaches, but in some way you're going to engage with their religious proclivities. And the question really of a secular state, although you know, Britain still is a Christian state, we still have a queen who's head of state and head of church, but in reality we are a secular state. Our policies are founded on secular liberal values, and therefore to what extent should the government really be engaging with individuals in persuading them to hold certain religious convictions or not? And then that comes down to the logic behind early intervention, that actually if you have an individual who's starting to experiment with soft drugs, do we engage with them because they may lead to harder drugs? Or if you have an individual who's truanting, a young kid who's truanting from school, and we think that actually we've seen them around, they may get involved with gangs, do we have an engagement, an early intervention? And the same logic applies here, that actually we should have an early intervention if you've got a kid mouthing off about how great it is to see ISIS videos, you know, to see beheadings, or to talk about how evil Assad is, because he's an evil man that's killed hundreds of thousands of people, and to feel the need to go out and do something about it. That whatever it may be, that actually that may require some form of intervention. And the other side of that, I think, is more the problematic criticism. So, as I mentioned, there's a difference between pursue, which is the investigative side, and prevent, which the strand of channel intervention is one side of prevent. It actually has nothing to do with the investigation side, has nothing to do with the surveillance side, has nothing to do with the intelligence gathering. But there is a lobby, in which is cleverly called Preventing Prevent, which has brought onto this idea that actually, you know, the state, which is inherently evil, I get that, and therefore what we should do is monitor everything the state does, which is good, but then it becomes, actually the state must be using this for intelligence gathering. It must be spying. It must be targeting the Muslim community, and therefore all of these things come into this kind of anti-prevent narrative. Now, some of those things can be easily dismissed. 25% roughly of individual referrals in the UK are actually far-right referrals, have got nothing to do with Muslims or Islamists, actually to do with right-wing extremists who are planning plots, etc. that actually the overriding majority has mentioned that there isn't necessarily a specific, there may not necessarily be a specific theological engagement. Many of the referrals do come from within the Muslim community out. So it isn't, although it's described as targeting Muslim communities or it was described as gathering intelligence, some of those things are just factually unfounded. And you have to remember people also have political, you know, it's not surprising that an organization, which I will mention, which has previously supported Abu Qatada and Anwar Oleki, the American, one of yours, the American terrorist preacher for Al-Qaeda Yemen, is very critical of the Prevent program. Well, obviously, they're going to be because they're pro-Al-Qaeda. They're Al-Qaeda apologists, and they believe in the legitimacy of Al-Qaeda resistance to American hegemony. So therefore, you've got to understand there are going to be some groups which have, which buy into a lot of the Islamist narrative and therefore going to present that. So it is, it's complicated, but actually there's good and bad reasons for the criticism, but on the whole, I think a lot of the criticism is based on propaganda rather than actual analysis.
So, Daniel, I want to turn back to you. You know, the counterterrorism part of my brain hears about early interventions and says, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You focus very narrowly on people who may become a problem. They've demonstrated they really like the propaganda of a violent group. That's the one you really want to focus on. But then the American part of my brain speaks up and says, well, wait a minute. I mean, these folks are entitled to free speech like anyone else. This isn't exactly criminalizing speech, but it seems to get right up on the line, if not over. And I'm trying to figure out how to strike this balance. And I gather from your comments that a lot of it has to do with the unique political culture in each country. You know, if we were in Germany, they would have a different answer versus in the United States. But how do we find that line? How do we keep this focus on a very narrow problem without running afoul of the proud tradition of free speech that we all value in a liberal society?
I think that is the core question of how you make de-radicalization or intervention programs work. And as you have mentioned, de-radicalization has a built-in moral problem. It works, usually, is supposed to work in a democratic, pluralistic society that is based on freedom of speech, freedom of political opinion and religion. But we know, on the other side, that starting when something criminal happens, a criminal act, or the prison system, is much more ineffective, is much more expensive, and we know that there is a process leading to that criminal act, leading to violence, that is dangerous, inherently dangerous to democratic society, because it embraces an ideology, it spreads an ideology that is actively attacking and subversing and trying to destroy the democratic, pluralistic society. So neo-Nazis in Germany, for example, have always tried to hide under that freedom of speech, freedom of political opinion, and even though the German version of freedom of speech and regarding to right-wing extremism is much more restrictive than in the U.S., obviously, for traditional reasons. So I would say that this problem, to figure out this problem when inherently dangerous process starts, and balancing it against what is morally acceptable in terms of a program is essentially a question of how do you structure that program and who finances the program? Is it active or passive? For example, I get the fact that I'm very critical about government-run active programs who try to change a political religious worldview, for example, in prison. And there are programs who are more or less coercive in prison, they would say, you're free to participate, but if you don't expect to be out here too soon, don't expect to get any special or beneficial treatment, anything like that. So then, on the other hand, there are non-governmental programs that can have close cooperation, should have with the government, but they have an own political philosophy. They say, we are part of a civil society, we are part of the society at large, and we are passive, so people come to us when they want help. And we are transparent. We say, most of these NGOs say, we have an own version of how democracy goes. We have an own version of what pluralism is, what democracy is. And if you come to us for help, this is what we expect in turn. Right? So in these instances, de-radicalization can be morally completely acceptable in a democratic pluralistic society because there are many NGOs. People are free to choose. They are free to leave. They can go to another NGO. So I think it should be right somewhere in the middle. I have just a couple of months ago, I've worked with the new Dutch program, and they're currently building a new de-radicalization strategy and program. And they have set out a very interesting framework to – they have very specifically set out the framework where they work and how they work in close cooperation with NGOs, especially trained experts. And they are very firm and strong on their own political philosophy because they've recognized that intervening when people end up in prison or have done something or shortly before doing something is far too ineffective and too expensive. We need to figure out, especially in Northern America, what actually is the point where we figure out that it's not acceptable. This kind of ideology, this embracement, this kind of propaganda spreading is really trying to destroy that society you are actually living in that protects you. And I think de-radicalization programs, when they are public-private partnerships, they can benefit from both sides of it. They can say you are protected in a certain area, but what they're doing now is directly aiming at abolishing these rights, these central principles, these constitutional rights. Just ask yourself the question, if this system you are propagating would be realized to 100% right now in the U.S., would any person who's not part of your group, racial group or religious group, have different or the same rights? So how would you treat them? Would you, from today to tomorrow, violently try to force them to leave the country? Would you put them in camps? Would you grant them like much lesser rights of speech? Would they have to pay an extra tax? Would they be killed right away? So these indicators, I think, are very essential to figure out where you're going in that.
Thank you, Daniel. So I hear Daniel, and you know, it's I can feel the response in the audience from Americans that it's a very European perspective. And in this country, we let an awful lot of stuff fly. And so I wonder, again, Rashad, how does the United States, which has barely put its toe in the water of these sort of interventions, how does it find that line?
Well, I think actually I was going to come in on a couple of things. In the UK as well, it's a voluntary process. So there cannot be any coercive approach towards individuals. They either choose to engage or they don't. And if they choose to engage, then it's a voluntary process of them dealing with the whole de-radicalization or prevention strategy. So in that sense, it is something that the state supports, it lends its support to.
But if they're radicalized, why would they engage?
Well, this is a very different question. So why do radicals engage? I mean, I don't know if I should make any comments. It's inappropriate for me to talk about Trump or anything like that, isn't it?
So let loose.
The thing is, why do people put themselves forward? Because they fundamentally believe they have something to offer, no matter how utterly ridiculous it may be. They believe they have something alternative to offer for the betterment of humanity or society or their people. So it's either a benevolent or a nationalistic motive. And so actually they want to engage because they partly want to persuade the rest of society around them that their radical worldview is genuinely better for the U.S. or for their communities or for the Muslim majority countries or for British Muslims. So actually, that's one reason they want to proselytize their point of view. Secondly, with a lot of individuals, they obviously have doubts about what they're doing as well. So human beings aren't black and white. They generally have a set of complexities that are pushing them towards engaging with other people. So the reason you have leakage is because people also want an intervention. It's the same reason why people will talk about suicide, because they are feeling, and when they do, we know that we should take it seriously, but actually they are reaching out for help as well. And so there's those factors that mean that actually in almost all cases, you have a high rate of people that will want to engage with you. Now, I don't think that is a problem because we do similar early interventions. The problem really here is because it seems like we're controlling the political persuasion of people or the religious proclivities of people. And that is really where we have a problem, because we do believe in free speech. And in that sense, I think there are some very reasonable criticisms to be made of what's called the counter-extremism policy in the UK, or which is something I think is impossible in the US, because they're talking about disruption orders for people that have extreme views but are legal, for people that aren't inciting violence but are anti-democratic, anti-pluralistic, and anti-liberal. And they're talking about banning organizations that promote or undermine pluralism, democracy, and human rights, or basic liberty. Now, that is something I think is absolutely impossible in the US context, thankfully. And there are lots of people, both on the right and the left wing political spectrum in the UK, who are fighting hard against that, because it is quite a horrific, conservative, aggressive idea. On the other side of that, I think there is a moral imperative of civil society as a whole to stand up and do something about this. And so what really you have with the counter-extremism and counter-terrorism measures is a partnership between government, you mentioned this earlier, a partnership between government and between civil society to say, actually, we as civil society can engage in the de-radicalization process, in the prevention process, in countering these arguments, and government's role may be to support or facilitate that. If there's a socio-political economic interest in doing so, and actually the argument put out on an economic basis alone is sound, say actually we should do something, and on a social moral perspective that actually we can't sit back and do nothing about this. To explain what I mean, we've had a huge number of migrants coming out of Syria and Iraq. I think Europe is talking about 2 million people, between 1 million and 2 million people at European borders. And people are talking about, are we taking extremists into Europe, and all sorts of debates. Well, actually, from Europe, we've exported a whole bloody brigade of 5,000 extremists to go and join ISIS. You know, so on the one hand, we have a moral responsibility to not send terrorists abroad, which is essentially what we've been doing. And hence my point about Al-Awlaki earlier, that actually we have contained, incubated, and created these things. And so we have a responsibility to do something in the policy space as well.
Thank you. Angela, I'm still trying to find this line, this balance between public and private. You're deputy director of a private NGO. If you can, just talk, and you can talk about in the abstract if you like, but what's the right relationship between an NGO that does these early interventions and the government? Or should there not be one at all?
Are you trying to get me in trouble?
Not at all.
Well, from our perspective, we all can play a part in interventions and disengagement, but we have to define the roles, what's needed, and who's best suited for each different aspect. So, for instance, the easiest example I can give is when I was an adolescent and I was becoming radicalized, I was getting involved, I was headed towards violence, I'm always asked, what would have stopped you? What could have been done? What kind of person could have approached you? What would you have heard that would have changed your mind? And I've thought about this for years, and I know with the kind of teenager that I was, it would have taken someone with real life experience that actually understood what I felt, what I was going through, the obstacles that I faced, the issues that I dealt with. So I think when we go out and look at these relationships, there has to be support. There have to be people who can go out and act. You know, there have to be all these different aspects of it. This may be unpopular, and I apologize if it is. I do not believe that relationship between NGOs like mine and, say, law enforcement should in any way be intelligence. It should not be telling on people, giving up information. If we are to truly go in there and do this work, we have to create communities of trust. Another example I can give, when we get feedback, for instance, we recently produced 4 PSA messages. We targeted individuals currently involved in the violent far right in the U.S. We expected a negative response, but in essence, what we're doing out there is saying, number one, we've been there, we've had the experience, we know what it's like. So behind closed doors, when you're feeling like this really isn't what you thought it was going to be, you know, there are things that you just didn't understand. Those feelings of guilt or shame or doubt are creeping in. We get a response from some individuals that is so intense, so filled with rage. And we'll hear things like, you're the worst traitors of all because you knew the truth and you walked away. And those are the kind of responses that are telling us we're striking nerves. We're doing a good job because those individuals that are voicing that, they're probably the ones that are having those doubts. They're the ones entertaining them, and they feel ashamed. They think they're going to get caught. They don't know what to do. So when we look at things like that and start to build these relationships between government, between NGOs and, you know, people on the ground, we need to keep this in mind. I'm going to be a lot more successful going out and doing some intervention work, some CBE, because I'm a credible voice, because I've been there. And especially with the far right in the U.S., we're dealing with people that cling to conspiracy theories, paranoia. Right. They already don't trust the government or law enforcement. So we need to be very clear about those lines in the relationship there. So there's always room for collaboration. We all have a part to play. We just need to define those roles very carefully.
Thank you. Daniel, you had a point you wanted to
make? I wanted to comment on this very problematic or highly debated question of the relationship between an intervention program, the clients, and the authorities, the security agencies. And I know that there are programs run by intelligence agencies who just use that for hard intelligence gathering, names, addresses, group structures, anything like that, which actually hurts the idea of intervention, but also hurts the families. It puts the families at risk or the social environment at risk and is accepting the risk to burn them by simply getting a couple of names. But I'm very positive about counterterrorism effects of deaccusation programs. So many people think, especially I expect in the U.S., that deaccusation is seen as a weird, soft approach to something that should be handled by the pros, by agents, FBI, intelligence. So if you look at how some deradicalization programs operate, and many include former police officers, former intelligence officials or experts, former military, they know what they're doing. They do risk assessment and counter-radicalization, deradicalization in an area that overlaps. So you can identify concrete aspects or effects, like you reduce the manpower of a terrorist group. You pull out human skills and knowledge out of that group. That group needs to refill that gap, needs to invest resources in recruitment and train other people within the hierarchy, and it's proven that this organizational cost that you put on to these groups by getting people out can even cause a complete collapse of a terrorist group or radical cell. Plus, what I would call soft intelligence gathering. I'm not talking about individual names and addresses, but, for example, you locate where a new recruiter is active or a new group is active or a new topic of recruitment is active or a new style of jihadism or neo-Nazism has emerged. And obviously, that is something you can pass on to the authorities. You gain a lot special knowledge about radicalization process, about connections that you can use in training and skill building for probation staff, for police, for teachers. That is very, very influential, very important, and you make the work of law enforcement much easier, much more effective by providing that additional angle, working with families and informers or people who want to get out themselves, closes the gap of that network, of counterterrorism network, and actually it helps to remove a blindfold of that area, that social milieu, that social area where radicalization occurs. And you can actually help the police to become much more effective in that.
Thank you. I want to open it up for questions, but before I do, I want to ask Lorenzo a final one. But I'm in a think tank. You're in a think tank. We have to think in our tanks about what kind of policies come out of this stuff. And
you and I have been thinking a lot about why it is we don't have intervention programs in the United States for political radicalism. I mean, even Angela's program, you were telling me, is unique in this country. And I know on the, working on jihadism, there's the WORD organization in D.C. and some others that work on it. But it's still in its very nascent stage. And there hasn't been a lot of support from the U.S. government for these kind of efforts. I've got my own ideas as to why, but I'm curious as why you think there hasn't been a groundswell in the government for these kind of programs.
It's a very good question. I think there's a combination of reasons, overlapping reasons there. I think, first of all, there's not really even a debate into building some kind of intervention when it comes to the right-wing extremism or other forms of extremism. The debate is just on the jihadist threat.
Right.
And again, that's something that, again, we can discuss that. But even on that side of the threat for that form of extremism, we have seen a lot of talk, but in reality, very little resources, very little action. And I think there's a variety of reasons. One is the fact that at the end of the day, the threat has not been as big, the domestic side of it is at least, as not in some European countries. We've never seen the sense of urgency that exists in a lot of European countries. If you, at the end of the day, look at which European countries have been the most active, are those that have been touched by some kind of attack.
So, is it even worth doing that if the scale?
I think that's the better. I would argue yes, some small scale kind of intervention, yes. But I'm saying that has somewhat prevented the initial trigger. The Dutch have been very active, yes, after the Van Gogh assassination. The Brits very active, yes, after 7/7. So there was always a trigger event. And you can argue we've had some of those in the U.S., the Boston Marathon bombings. I think to some degree that has been a bit of a trigger. In fact, Boston is a pilot city now when it comes to CV. But for one reason or the other, and I think to some of it is justified, the numbers here are so much smaller than in most European countries, so there is not that sense of urgency. Add to that the fact that the tools that law enforcement has here are so much more powerful than most European countries. I mean, at the end of the day, the FBI can do its nice sting operations, which no European law enforcement agency can do, and it's a very safe space. Now, we can talk about the problems, the ethical problems, the community engagement issues that go with that, but if you are the FBI, it's a very nice tool to have. It's very effective from that point of view, and I think a lot of it has to do, and I'm acknowledging you as somebody that has written a lot about this issue, which is Jerry. The FBI is an organization that is very much based on numbers, on effectiveness. If you run an FBI field office somewhere, you make a good name for yourself. You make a career based on the number of people you prosecute, not the number of people you prevented from radicalizing. And I think that the fact that the FBI has such a big role and the FBI has this sort of mentality, and again, I'm not necessarily saying that in a negative way, prevents a lot of discourse to go forward in the state.
Lorenzo, would you also say it's political culture as well? Because
absolutely.
Reading the channel document, which it channels the program that intervenes in the UK, that document's a very sober document. They talk about risk, what happens if someone goes through the program and then carries out an act, who gets the blame, what happens. My sense here, in addition to everything you say, is that politically also, no one wants to put their name on this kind of program because they're terrified that one person goes through the program, carries out an attack, the program's done, the person's career is done,
yeah.
He signed off on it.
But I think that's actually the reality in which we are now, which is somewhat problematic. Because
right.
We are seeing, as I was saying earlier, that the FBI and more in general the counterterrorism community understands that they need to use these kind of tools. And they are occasionally, sporadically doing it, but without clear guidelines. So we see cases when it comes to minors, where we see cases like the Connolly, people with mental issues, like the case in Denver, where the FBI or other agencies, but it's mostly the FBI, does this kind of interventions, but they do not really have guidelines on how to do that, and the legal part is absolutely one of the big ones. So that's one of the things that, to some degree, we've been advocating as a center. Do it, but do it right. Do it with the right training. Do it with the right knowledge. Do it with the right partners, and do it with the right legal guidelines. That goes for the FBI. but also goes for people in the community that want to help. It's a concern that we hear from people in the community. They do want to help, but without clear guidelines, they are afraid that engaging with somebody who's an extremist and might potentially become a terrorist, they're going to be charged as for material support to terrorism, which potentially that's something that might happen. So to work in that space that everybody recognizes, most people recognize, is the next step for U.S. counterterrorism policies domestically. It needs to happen, but it needs to happen with some clear guidelines coming from the top. And I think that's what we're not seeing.
And the top means Department of Justice?
That's actually one of the other reasons, the problems that we see is that there's a lot of entities that are somewhat fighting on who should be running that space. The whole alphabet soup of agencies there, everybody sort of claiming one part of the portfolio. So it's DHS, FBI, NCTC, we do not have a leading agency there, of course, although some things are moving there. But those, and then you have the federal, the state, and the local level. All those issues come together, and really where nobody really taking charge of this.
Yeah. Okay, let me open it up to the audience now. Let's see. Down front here, please.
Thanks very much. This is a fascinating discussion. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to focus, if I can, specifically on the jihadi and ISIS sort of cluster and pose two questions, if I can. One is, as opposed to far-right radicals or neo-Nazis, et cetera, one is some of us have attended sessions in this very room on the role of messaging and counter-narratives, and I would be interested to know, particularly as I listen to what Angela had to say about how you do this successfully, I'm interested to know whether and to what extent you think messaging and counter narratives can have some success in this process of keeping people from stepping over the edge. And then second, if it's appropriate or if there's time, I'm interested to know how you evaluate the considerable work that the Saudis do on this issue and how you evaluate that.
Okay, so we have a question about the efficacy of counter-messaging and then a more particular question about the Saudis. Who wants to take
Saudi from me?
If you want to start with that. Obviously, there's a long tradition of material acquisition intervention programs in the Middle East and in South Asia, and Saudi Arabia is leading that. I think they were classified as an active government, highly ideological program. So what they try to do is, with a lot of money, with a lot of effort, to replace jihadism with Wahhabism, which is not that far away. Nothing of this, nothing of what they do could work in a Western country, to be clear. What they do is they have a very strong sense of what is necessary in the practical dimension of deratization. So getting financial support to marry, getting financial support for moving out, getting a home. They even buy these people an own car. They finance the families to come in and meet them in prison. So the practical dimension is very good, and I think there's no Western country who would put so much resources into that kind of work. In terms of evaluating it, there is no de-radicalization program on that planet who would not claim 100% success rate, or at least a high success rate. The Saudi program is no different. They say they have a 95% success rate. If I remember correctly, it was just a year or 2 years ago where they arrested an 88-person Al-Qaeda cell in Saudi Arabia. And I think about 50 of the persons were graduates from the program. There were a number of terrorist plots led by graduates from the program. There has been no scientific evaluation of the program whatsoever. So the only information that comes is from people who run it, who finance it, say 95% success rate. They're all good, they go out, and then there are Wahhabists or whatever you want to call it. So this touches the issue of evaluation of de-radicalization program, and I'm very critical and skeptical. I am convinced that de-radicalization can be evaluated, should be evaluated, and can be effective. There are a lot of questions like data access, the relationship of the researcher and the program, who finances it, who has an interest in a positive or negative evaluation. It's highly complex and highly political. I think the Saudi program is so popular in the Muslim majority world because it's very outspoken in terms of we teach them the right form of Islam. Right? We sit down and debate them out of it. In Western countries, I've never seen that work in practice. When these jihadi kids are in prison and you send in an imam who sits down, opens up the Quran, and says, no, you listen, and this is the Islam how it should be. They have no reason to listen. They say, first of all, you're not a real Muslim. They practice takfirism. So they say, why should I listen to you? You're a government-paid, westernized Muslim or government Muslim, so I do not listen. And they simply say it because they want to get out of prison earlier. So I think it's an interesting program. It should be definitely taken into account what can be done practically in terms of art classes, in terms of financial support and sustainability. The ideological component, I'm very critical about that. And I just know what has been written in the media, what has been written in some very rare studies about the program. So there needs to be a real evaluation.
And Michelle, on the question of counter-messaging, I mean, is it worthwhile to do, given that ISIS has gone out of its way to anger most Muslims in the world? I mean, you don't light a fellow Sunni Muslim on fire unless you intend to put your finger in the eye of every Muslim. I mean, we don't message as a government against neo-Nazism. It's just mainstream culture has already decided it's a pretty vile ideology. Should we be doing counter-messaging?
I think it fits into the last question as well. That look, the Saudi program is essentially saying you should only really engage in acts of terrorism when we tell you to do so, and otherwise it's just wrong. And that's the substance of their kind of theology. That's what it boils back down to. So that obviously is going to be beset with all sorts of issues. There's the credibility thing that you mentioned, that actually when you're engaging with somebody in prison, that you're acting on behalf of state, and if they already deny the state, you're starting on a negative already. Having said that, I actually, my experience has been very different in the DRAD space in the UK, that actually we've looked at over 100 cases over the last 6 or 7 years, and actually in that space, the overriding majority that we've looked at, where there has been a theological or ideological component in the de-radicalization, it has taken place and there's continuous engagement since. So in my experience, actually, it can be done. I just don't believe that the religious specific perspective of the Saudis is necessarily the most appropriate way to do it. Looking across the world, Indonesia, Morocco, Egypt, all have various different takes on it. So Indonesia do the wraparound thing where they do the whole ideological dimension, the theology, and taking care of the individual and their families, etc., on the cases where they convict terrorists as an example. So they've got a lot that we can learn from in that respect. Coming down to this is why I think the messaging, if it's calibrated appropriately and it has the right messenger, it can be effective and influential. So there are various different groupings of people, if you like. So you've got the bloodthirsty, probably neo-sociopath, who wants to go and join ISIS because they've burnt this Jordanian pilot alive. Because, you know, as you explain in your book, actually they are successful primarily, that's the apocalypse by Will McCants. Because actually they are sociopaths and they're attracted to the savagery. But the other thing you mentioned in your book that's really interesting is the management of savagery by Obakar Naji, which is a book about how you need to be really savage in order to win. And that's what modern jihadism should be. And then he just explains the tactics around it. And one of the things that you mention is that actually he talks about just the random killing of women and children and civilians. And you explain that this is in direct contravention of a rare mass transmitted prophetic saying, which is Nayan Khatam Nisab al-Wildan, the prohibition of killing women and children. And actually, coming from an academic voice, which is not political, which is, you know, essentially just someone looking at this, that would resonate a lot with the young people that I speak to, because actually that's an objective, not Muslim, doesn't even have to be Muslim, but an academic who's not interested in the politics, but is just pointing out, you know something, your religion is not bloodthirsty in that sense. And therefore, that actually does have a lot of resonance with people. And I'm saying that experientially, because I, you know, engage with young individuals from various different spectrums. So in that sense, the messaging, if it's calibrated appropriately from different messengers. So yes, the US state may not be the most, you know, credible messenger to a jihadi. You know, it's fairly reasonable to say. But then there's going to be academic voices like yourself, there's going to be Muslim voices who, and there's going to be theological voices. And then there'll be people that are various levels of persuasion. Some that buy into the politics will see actually their religion tells them that no matter how much you dislike, you know, a particular government, it never justifies a terrorist act. So then that messaging may have that impact. So it depends, really. I know it's not a great answer, but calibrating and getting the right messenger will determine how effective the messaging is. And I firmly believe, actually, it can be effective.
Gentleman in the brown jacket here in the middle.
Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Stefan Leder. I'm a retired analyst, but worked for, among other places, a unit in the State Department called the Counterterrorism Communications Center, 2008-09. The strategy that we worked on at that time was to mobilize voices in the Islamic community to do the counter-messaging that we've been talking about. Not from the U.S. government, but to mobilize people in the Islamic community, which would be perhaps more acceptable voices to the target audience that we're talking about. And I think that's still a valid approach. I'd be interested in further comments on that.
Yeah, I mean, if I could put a wrinkle on that as well, and Angela and Lorenzo, please jump in. What happens when the communities don't radicalize, right? Like we're talking about far-right extremism. You know, there's not been a big movement to push back against that. I mean, you were saying that yours is one of the first in the United States to push back to it. Does the government need to fill that space? Does it need to quietly encourage non-governmental organizations to do it, or should it be more laissez-faire about it and just sit back and wait to see what happens?
From my perspective, I know the numbers aren't great, but I don't think we can afford to wait to see what happens. And I'll give an example for that. It could be something as simple as a community being empowered with knowledge. What do we do if we see X, Y, and Z? And for that example, I will use the Charleston shooting. That individual publicly stated to several people that he was going to go out and commit acts of violence. If that community was empowered, if they weren't afraid or think, I don't want to call the police, who do I go to? I don't know if it's a credible threat. And with that example, I will say that we can't afford not to do something. We can't afford to say, well, the numbers aren't that big, so we can just let it go. The numbers are getting bigger. Mm-hmm. Certainly not on the scale, you know, with other things that we've seen. But there's a problem.
And when you say we, you mean private citizens need to mobilize to set up more NGOs like yours?
Well, I'm into all kinds of stuff. I tow the academic field. I tow, you know, some different stuff. So I would say we as a community, mm-hmm. all of us who are engaged in this kind of work, whether it's on the academic side, whether it's on, you know, intervention, CVE, counter-narratives, policy, that's what I mean.
Needs to take right-wing extremism more seriously. Is
absolutely,
what you're saying.
Uh-huh. Yes.
All right, let me get another question from the audience.
Can
sure.
Just because I think there's something that you can avoid that's happened in Britain, and to a large extent across different European countries. But look, the failure in Britain was that civil society didn't stand up against the phenomena of radical Islamism. That's just why the government now is reacting with this fairly regressive counter-extremism policies in terms of trying to disrupt extremist activities, ban organizations, give ASBOs, if you know an ASBO is an antisocial behavior order, where we stop individuals speaking in public because they have extreme views. I mean, I think that reaction is terrible, but the reaction is because civil society has failed to challenge the ideology. What do I mean by that? I mean, we have, as an example, the leader of the Labour Party, literally the leader of the opposition in the UK, the main opposition in the UK, Jeremy Corbyn, who's someone who's invited Raed Salah to come into Parliament in the UK, who describes Hezbollah and Hamas as his friends. You know, these are bloodthirsty terrorist organizations which also do a lot of good social work. Essentially, but they have terrorist fringes and terrorist groups as part of them, parcel of their makeup. Yet civil society has actually allowed them to be incubated within parts of mainstream society. So this is one area where we can benefit and heed the words of John Stuart Mill, which was, look, don't embrace your values as historic tradition. And you forget why you fought for the separation of powers. Why you decided there should be no religious test in your constitution. You know, there's a reason and rationale why you decided that when you formed your constitution. It's the same reason why it's amazing thinking some of your presidential candidates will be seeing. You know, but essentially there's the values that underpin that intellectually you have to stand up for. We failed to do that. And I think this is why we're seeing a lot of the regressive measures. And I think that comes in both with your Muslim communities and everybody. Muslim or not, must share that stake in standing up for, you know, common, what, you know, the American dream, whatever your particular aspirations and values on life, liberty, and fruit of the loom.
Lorenzo, you want to make it? You want to make it?
Of the fruit of the loom, what can I say? No, but I think what Rashad is saying is very fitting to the UK dynamics, but doesn't really apply to the US. And I think a lot of this, what we discuss is very country-specific, exactly what you were saying about Saudi, words in Saudi, but it doesn't. You know, the countries, you know, here in the U.S., we do not have a problem with communities radicalizing. We have a problem with scattered individuals. Occasionally, small clusters of four or five individuals, somewhat of an online community, but it's a completely different dynamic. So the counter-messaging, the working with communities, great stuff. It can hurt, although in some cases, if not done properly, it can actually hurt. But for the most part, we're talking about individuals here and there who are radicalizing with communities that are generally rejecting some of the more radical messages, unlike some important part of the British Muslim community, which have a different take. You know? So it's a very different dynamic here. So some of the big role of the state, some of the, again, kind of social engineering, some of the needs for the communities to really speak out. I'm not saying that would hurt in the U.S., but are not necessarily needed. It's not a matter of communities. Maybe there's something to be said about the Somali part of the Somali community in Minneapolis, but generally speaking, it's few individuals who are not part of the community. We just, shameful in pitching always our stuff, but we have a study that we did on ISIS in America. We looked at the 70 individuals have been indicted in the U.S. for links to ISIS since 2014. 40% of them are converts, don't really belong to communities. Most of them are actually very new converts or just people that for a variety of reasons, but in most cases belong to the fourth category, Rashad was saying, people with some weird personal issues, radicalized. So outreach to communities doesn't really do much in that cases. So a lot of this stuff doesn't really apply to the U.S. So it has to be very country-specific.
All right, thank you. Let me gather a few questions. Gentlemen, the baseball cap in the back.
Thank you very much for an interesting discussion. My name is Ken Dante, and my work was with addicts. I worked with recovering people as a therapist. And I just wanted to see if there was some comparison to addiction treatment. People need information basically to be able to self-diagnose. And if you can diagnose them forever, but if they don't have a self-diagnosis, they really don't take steps. And part of that is a measure of, I'll call it soul sickness. And I've seen that even in guys who are in combat, who were working with, you know, radical organizations, and even people in the IDF got disgusted with what they were doing and had to make a journey. But they also needed to have charismatic individuals around them who served as elders. And that would be almost like a sponsor in AA or a sponsor in recovery, but perhaps this would be someone who really had the charisma of having gone through this difficult journey back. And I'm wondering if you might want to just talk about that comparison, if that holds valid.
Thank you. Let me gather a few more questions. There was one in the back. Nope, her hand's not going up. There it is.
Hello, my name's Claire O'Connor. I'd love to hear the panel's view on some of our quote-unquote allies' approach to countering violent terrorists, for example, Egypt and Turkey and Israel.
Thank you. Let's take another down here in front, please.
Thank you very much for a fascinating discussion. Alexander Kravitz from Insight. I'm curious if any of your groups or you know of other groups that might actually have become a target for some of these violent, you know, extremists. I mean, when you think of the example that you were saying, that you essentially end up dismembering a cell, it's just it's a soft way of destroying it, right? So ultimately you are an enemy, and I'm just curious if that is something that, you know, is of concern.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's take those questions. Just to remind you, we have a question about similarities with addicts and what do you do with people that have a problem but aren't willing to take the next steps. We have another question about the way that some states in the Middle East handle radicalization, namely Egypt, Turkey, and Israel. And then the final question about whether any of you or if you've heard of anyone being a target as a consequence of doing this de-radicalization work?
Gosh, I think that the last question, yeah, lots of people that do get involved do end up becoming targets, at least in the UK, or have threats put against them if they're not targets. So there is that risk for people that get involved. With regards to essentially the psychology of individual de-radicalization, I'm loath to try and pathologize it, and I think there's a danger in pathologizing radicalization as though it's a phenomenon we don't understand, as though it's somehow subhuman. I actually think it's fairly normal. It's just that we tend to live in liberal bubbles, and the rest of the world isn't really like that, which I think kind of comes to the last question, which is, yeah, some of the horrific practices of the Egyptian government is something we should stay very far away from in terms of suppressing through violent means, not even terrorists, but actually just political radicals, people who we may not see eye to eye with in our values, and we may think some of their ideas are horrific, but we shouldn't really be supporting the horrific suppression and repression of the Muslim Brotherhood. Whether we think it's effective or not is irrelevant. It's just wrong. The Israel, really, how long have you got? I'm going to avoid Israel, but yeah, Turkey as well has become more and more authoritarian. And that is a problem.
I have an anecdote to that. At a conference, I met colleagues from Turkey, from the police, and this conference was about de-radicalization. So I talked a lot about this intervention, de-radicalization talks, ideology, all that stuff. And then the Turkish colleagues stand up and said, yeah, we do de-radicalization. So what we do is, we kick in their doors 3 a.m. in the morning, and we have this big stick, and we just hit them on the head and put them in the jail, and they're de-radicalized, right? So this was, at that point, their understanding of de-radicalization, neutralizing a threat. I know that they have changed a little bit in their community outreach project, so they have a lot stronger community policing aspects, where police officers would go uninvited to marriage and just hand out gifts and just be present and be nice and be open. But they don't have, to my knowledge, they don't have individual de-radicalization intervention programs. There was the question of the threat
against people who are engaging in that work. I think you have to differentiate between those who are formers themselves, who naturally get attacked and threatened by the former groups because they're an inherent threat to these groups, and those who are not, who are professionals and come from another background. And it's the way how you frame these counter-narratives, how you frame these interventions. To give you another example of counter-narrative intervention, I'm leading a group together with the inspirational Christiane Boudreau from Canada, which is called Mothers for Life. It's a group of currently mothers from 9 countries across the globe who all have lost their sons and daughters in Syria. Most of them have been killed in Syria and Iraq. And in summer, these mothers wrote an open letter to Islamic State and posted on various social media sites, and you can find everything about that online. The idea was, next to formers, mothers are in a central position to challenge beliefs and ideologies because there is this famous saying of the Prophet, paradise lies at the feet of your mother. So the mother, irregardless of the faith, irregardless of the ethnic background language, she is still the mother, and she has still something to say about that. So we wrote that letter, deliberately used certain jihadi terms, described how these mothers felt after their sons and daughters had been killed without the mothers having a chance to intervene against that. And would you guess how long it took for Islamic State to officially respond to that? 3.5 hours. After 3.5 hours, an official IS Twitter account tried to scorn and ridicule the message. After a couple of days, when the letter was translated into 8, 9, 10 languages, they shifted their response in posting jihadi recruitment videos in the comment section under articles about the letter, saying, well, you might have a point there, but jihad is really something different, and you misunderstood what we actually do with this, and how here are videos showing that we just work out, and it's training, and it's nice. So the response shifted from ridiculing and rejecting it to acknowledging parts of the message and trying to turn it around. So we were able to engage in a message. None of these mothers were actually directly threatened after that. Even me as a family counselor or as an expert in that, I was never actually directly threatened. And what you said, of course it is dismembering these groups. Of course it is dismembering the ideology and empowering those who are really, really dangerous to these groups by their simple biography, by their simple natural being. And I think this can be done in a way that these cells don't even recognize. These groups don't even recognize what is happening. It's simply getting more difficult to recruit. It's getting more difficult to hold your members in the cell. And suddenly, you are engaged in an internal controversy or argument with your own members, why the person left, why the comrade left. You know, why is these mothers saying that we shouldn't go to Syria, and we've been told the mothers are so important. So you create much more noise and flur within these groups that potentially create doubt and fallout from all the other sites, which you can use again, and rifts and all that stuff.
We have time for 2 more very quick questions if anyone has burning questions. Good. All right. Answered everyone's questions. Lorenzo, a final one for you. And that is, if you had one recommendation to make to the U.S. government, thinking through this stuff, you've looked at this issue in Europe, you've looked at it in the United States, what would that one suggestion be?
Easy question to end. Thank you. Appreciate that. I think it's a couple of things, just to expand a bit. One, it's resources. The bottom line has been a lot of talk about CV in America, resources. At the same time, we do not need a massive, large-scale program like the Saudis or some of the European programs. The problems are very limited, number-wise. So what I think we've been arguing as a center is that targeted interventions accompanied by the engagement, which is useful not just from a CVE, from a security point of view, and securitizing the relationship with communities is problematic per se. So keep the engagement, but at the same time start with intervention programs, with partnerships with community, open up the space for civil society, for NGOs to be partners, obviously with clear guidelines for everybody. And I think it's something that can be done relatively on the cheap. based on pre-existing structures, and I think would allow that law enforcement to zero in on the really problematic cases and not spend resources on the 15-year-old who's on Facebook just Googling Baghdadi and killing Shias just because it's a phase, and would allow the FBI to zero in. So it's a matter of resources put in the right way. It's not a matter of creating massive, massive structures.
Thank you very much, and join me, please, in thanking our panel today.